Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. It is Hard Knock Radio. We are here, Washington, D.C. Standing in front of us, a friend of the show from our sister station, WPFW. It is the one and only Jared Ball. How you doing? Dr. Jared Ball.
I'm as good as could be expected. It's always a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to talk to you because we are on the eve of celebrating Malcolm X's birthday. And, you know, the Malcolm X Jazz Festival coming up and all that sort of stuff. But also, I wanted to talk to you in particular because you were one of the many scholars and the lead scholar in pushing back on what many people felt was a book that did Malcolm an injustice. And we're talking about Manny Marable's piece. And you and a number of scholars came together to correct what you felt were erroneous pieces of information. Let's talk a little bit about that, Marable's book, and why you all wrote your book.
Well, again, thank you very much. And I prefer to be thinking of myself as part of a collective as opposed to any kind of leadership. But I am part of a group of people who were frustrated with the direction Marable's book went in describing Malcolm X and his life, and particularly the politics and the ideas with which Malcolm grappled, which we, for a variety of reasons, think are extremely important, even in 2013, given that so much of what Malcolm tried to change about the world remains unchanged. And in some cases is even worse today than when he was alive. So what we saw happening with Marable's book, whether it's the flaws of scholarship, lack of resource or lack of attributable sources, a very narrow view ideologically, a conservative narrow view, a liberal view rather, of Malcolm X, we saw that there were many problems that need to be addressed, and we wanted to do it as a collective. It was not something we thought one scholar could do. So we tried to bring together a group of people who, as Margot Arnold, one of our contributors, could address the fact that Marable's version of Malcolm X has given the black radical collective consciousness the blues. So we wanted to address that, and I think we did very well, very strongly.
Hold on 1 second. We're going to take a break. There we go. We're back here. Davey D hanging out with you, talking with Jared Ball. We're down here, Washington, D.C., continuing our conversation about this book. One of the things about it, Marable's book, that stood out, that caught everybody's attention, were the sensational, you know, Malcolm might have been gay, his wife was cheating on him, those types of things. And those are issues that you address, but you said there was actually something that was more compelling and more damaging in terms of how Malcolm was being positioned from being somebody who was radical, who changed the system, to almost somebody who would be, endorsing a Barack Obama and his policies.
Well, that for me was the biggest issue. And it's something that I found when I finally read the epilogue of the book, of Marable's book, where you can see how he is trying to resituate Malcolm X as someone clearly within the political trajectory that would culminate with a Barack Obama, as opposed to being what he was, which was somebody who was advocating a line of political reasoning and trajectory and organization that would be entirely in opposition to Barack Obama, particularly the policies that he espouses and the structures that put him in power in the first place. But this is what some have argued is necessary in the 21st century post-Obama. If you're going to write anything about black people and you want it to sell, certainly become a national bestseller, a posthumously awarded Pulitzer Prize in history type of book, you need to do something that is going to align Barack Obama with whatever trajectory of history you're describing. And this is for me an extreme problem, and for several of our contributors an extreme problem. The issues of his sexuality and infidelity are not attributed. They're not well sourced at all. There are no sources for them, in fact. And Marable just speculates wildly, using words like maybe and probably and might have repeatedly throughout the book. So those issues we deal with and address only to show how little substance there is to support them. And then many of our contributors, myself included, try to deal with the ideological repositioning of Malcolm X in what is, in fact, a reinvention of Malcolm X by Manning Marable, Columbia University, Viking Press, a subsidiary of Penguin, one of the six largest publishing houses in the world.
You know, you wrote an open letter this week. Well, it was written a week before, but people are just seeing it this week, to Cornel West, Tavis Smiley, who do radio. And I guess, you know, also to those who have sided with Maribel. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because it seems like, you know, from looking on the outside, people have been running away from a debate about this, especially with you and those scholars behind this book. It seems like there's a lot of money on the line, a lot of reputation on the line, and instead of risking a principled debate and comparing note by note, it's better just to quiet you and act like you don't exist.
Well, in almost all cases, the privilege of power, the privilege of being in the top spot, is that you don't have to accept all challengers in most cases. Politically, we've seen it certainly in the sports world, the fight game, and then we're seeing it also in academia. There's only been one somewhat of a debate that I've seen take place, and this was at the Left Forum, that involved only one of our contributors, Amiri Baraka, and several contributors to the Third World Press book of criticism that came out before ours, that involved Bill Fletcher, Hakeem Adibudi, and Amiri Baraka. But as of today, as of this date, I have not been invited. I have tried to get Zahir Ali, who is said to be the chief researcher for the Malcolm X Research Project at Columbia University, and for Manning Maribel. In fact, when the book first came out, I emailed Zahir Ali and invited him and his entire research team onto my radio program to debate me. And I told them I would give them all of my questions weeks in advance and allow their entire team to research those specific questions and come, you know, fully prepared. And was told many, many months later by Zahir Ali that he would never do that, that he would not ever do that. And three panels to which I've been invited that would have produced this kind of exchange, he has backed out once upon hearing that I would be there. But again, it's not just about me. It's that none of our collective scholars have been allowed to engage this debate. And my point to West and Smiley was that two journalists and scholars of their prominence, of their claimed left-leaning positions and love of Malcolm X, and, as they say, love of Manning Maribel, they should welcome it. Because if they continue to say, when they re-interview Zahir Ali by himself, they continue to talk openly about how Manning Maribel would have welcomed critical exchange and debate, but then they themselves deny us that opportunity. And again, this is not just about me. And those who are familiar with anything about publishing know that we are not going to make any money off of this book. In fact, it doesn't even help us necessarily with our careers, given that we're challenging one of the more prominent scholars in Black historical studies history, that is. But it's beyond that. But the real issue is, as I at least see it, is that those of us who need to hear vigorous discussion of Malcolm X, debate around his ideas and politics, and more importantly, to be encouraged to organize around them for 21st century, need to be exposed to these discussions. We can't just leave books to go unchallenged and spokespeople to go unchallenged, even as they build their careers off of these books and products, without challenging them to again, honor Malcolm X, to honor, more importantly, the collective and all of us who need to have these exchanges. So my point to West and Smiley was that, given their prominence and their knowledge, they should be aware of our book. They should be principled enough to include us on some level in the discussion, and encourage Zahir Ali to stand up and defend the book that he promotes, gets paid to promote, he's building a career off of, but has many flaws that the community deserves to have aired out in public.
You know, we're talking with Jared Ball. Your book itself, we want people to get an opportunity to get a hold of it. Talk about the chapters. You know, give us a breakdown. We get this book, what's inside?
Well, our book is A Lie of Reinvention, Correcting Manny Marable's Malcolm X. It came out last year on Black Classic Press out of Baltimore, an imprint run by the former member of the Black Panther Party in Baltimore, Paul Coates. And in our book, you get a collective of essays from people who worked with Malcolm, like A. Peter Bailey and Rosemary Mealy, to people who are political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, who wrote a brand new 2.0 review of Maribel's book, given time to reflect on it and see more flaws in it. You get scholars like Sundiata Chajiwa. You get members of the Malcolm X grassroots movement like Kali Akuno and Kamau Franklin. Other scholars like Patricia Reed Merritt and Margot Arnold that I already mentioned. In some of those essays, importantly, raising the critical issue of the relationship between Manning Maribel and Columbia University. and the omission in Marable's book of many prominent women who were not interviewed and whose perspectives were not included in the book as well. Greg Thomas, a brilliant scholar at Syracuse University, has one of the more powerful and brilliant pieces that really challenges the politics of sexuality and the way it's described, not only in Marable's book, but more broadly speaking. So you get a wide, again, intergenerational, all critical essays, but from various positions on the black political left continuum, with various experience in terms of, Kamau Franklin was even a lawyer for a time of one of the accused killers of Malcolm X. You get activists, you get scholars, you get journalists, you get political prisoners, you get, again, a wide variety of people. Chris Tinson, another brilliant scholar. Eugene Puryear, another brilliant scholar and activist.
So there's a bunch of y'all.
Oh, there's a group of us. That's what I'm saying. There's a whole collective of us that are saying, again, as Margot Arnold summarizes, the black radical collective consciousness has been given the blues, and we wanted to respond vigorously, and I think we've done so.
You know, which one stands out the most? I know you mentioned Margaret Arnold. Give us one, you know, that people absolutely need to read if they really want to capture the essence of Malcolm.
I mean, that's hard to say. I mean, you know, you have Bill Strickland, who has a piece in there, who knew Malcolm and some extent came up with him. I mean, my colleague, co-editor Todd Burrows, his coda to the piece is, I think, a brilliant summary of not only the politics of Malcolm X, but the politics around biography and journalism that impact us, in this case, negatively, to keep us away from the radical politics of a Malcolm X. It's hard to pick just one. I mean, Mumi Abu-Jamal makes the point that Marable's book is, quote, tragic in that it completely omits reference to the counterintelligence program, which the FBI says it in part started or used to target black America because of Malcolm
X. There's a tape with Malcolm talking with the FBI. I mean, that's a famous, you know, back and forth.
Absolutely. And that is not unacknowledged by Marable, but what Marable does very skillfully and with great nuance, and I think with great help from his editors at Viking Press, is take the existence of those kinds of exchanges with the FBI or the fact of their constant surveillance and diminishes the FBI to the point where after you've read 600 pages, you get the impression that the FBI was sort of a background surveillance entity only sort of watching this drama play out between Malcolm and the Nation of Islam, when in fact the FBI and the state itself were major actors in fomenting dissension between Malcolm and the Nation and in inspiring a condition where Malcolm would be assassinated, but also in benefiting from the assassination and were likely at least... There's a lot of room to question their direct involvement in the assassination beyond just sort of fomenting it in the background. And yet this is left sort of in the ether around Marable's book. In fact, Marable says Minister Farrakhan is the greatest beneficiary of Malcolm's assassination, which, for whatever that is worth in its own investigation, is certainly not the case, considering that the United States government and Western Empire in general benefited more than anybody from Malcolm's assassination, and were clearly involved, as Malcolm said himself, in doing what was being done to him at the end of his life.
You know, that dovetails into this, and we'll listen to some Malcolm. One of the strengths of Malcolm was his international outlook. And when we talk about this reinvention of Malcolm in terms of Marable, in him basically moving Malcolm from radicalness to, you know, progressive Democrat, if we could use that word, we see that trend also in, at least as your colleagues, you know, Bruce Dixon and Glenn Ford talk about the black political class, who are very visible, the punditry class. You see them absent from conversations that, you know, Malcolm would have weighed in. Libya, Benghazi, not the Benghazi with the four ambassadors being killed, but the Benghazi where there was ethnic cleansing that nobody's talking about in the States, but they're talking about everywhere else. You don't see the robust conversations about Mali and what does that mean, et cetera, et cetera. Or even AFRICOM, considering that what triggered Malcolm to be surveilled so heavily was his trips to Africa. So can you speak a little bit about Malcolm's internationalism and how that, you know, 40 years after the fact, it's kind of like, you know, it's said in such a way that it doesn't impact people to continue in that vein.
Well, I always like to point out that as Congressman John Lewis has pointed out in his own memoirs, when he was a part of SNCC in 1964 and traveled around the African continent on a path that followed Malcolm X, every African leader at that time was saying, if you're anywhere to the political right of Malcolm X, we don't want to hear from you. Making Malcolm the standard internationally for black politics in the world. What Marable does and what has been done to Malcolm since his assassination is to refigure Malcolm as somebody who would, as you said a moment ago, be more liberal, a liberal Democrat, and find happy acceptance in some of the international gatherings that we've seen in the world that it's hard to say would have been his clear vision, but I think are certainly predictably not the culmination of what he would have seen as his vision. Marable describes Malcolm as being a race-neutral pan-Africanist, which is an oxymoron, if I've ever heard one.
A race-neutral?
A race-neutral pan-Africanist, which is a very difficult phrase to unpack in a very short period of time, but I think it shows the trajectory that Marable is taking Malcolm on, away from his radical nationalism and his non-aligned world majority, people of color version of internationalism, his African-centered internationalism, and puts him into and brings Malcolm into a very safe liberal space where, by the end of Marable's book, he has Malcolm being equally critical of the 9/11 attacks against this country, and putting him in line against al-Qaeda with Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice in a way that I think there's no historical precedent or no historical example to suggest that would have been the case. I mean, he was the one, Malcolm, that is, was the one that famously used the phrase chickens coming home to roost post-Kennedy's assassination. And if we just flash forward to 2001 and look at what happened to people who took that same logic and applied it to 9/11, for instance, Ward Churchill, whose academic career has been largely destroyed, if at least temporarily sidetracked, because he took that logic and applied it to a speech he gave off campus about 9/11.
Right. And well, so, look at Sister Soldier, the Sister Soldier moment.
Absolutely.
And she used the phrase chickens coming home the roost.
That's another perfect example. So the idea then that Malcolm would have been condemning 9/11 and condemning al-Qaeda instead of raising critical questions, or to even conceive of a world that would exist as 2001 did had Malcolm been alive, is also a shaky ground to walk on. The world would have been mightily different had Malcolm not been assassinated, which is, of course, why he was. But when you start to see and this is, again, one of our points, that Malcolm, sort of a political child of the Bandung Conference and the non-aligned movement and the radical revolutionary movements coming from the African and Latin American worlds and the Asian communities, to reduce that to somebody who would have been a right-wing conservative critic of al-Qaeda, to have him be someone who was used by the book's end in Marable's case as someone who would condemn radical Islam is to deny, I think, the trajectory Malcolm X was on, the threat that he posed, and I think, again, importantly, reduces our ability right now to interpret the world in, I think, a more appropriate way, to understand the kinds of movements and organizational efforts we should be engaging in 2013, which is, again, I think, part of the point of the book, which, again, was one of the tenets of the counterintelligence program, to disassociate black youth from black revolutionary ideology. And I think that this is what this book was designed in part to do. It was designed for a very white, liberal, middle-class crowd, which would make it a New York Times and Washington Post bestseller and would allow it to be given posthumously, for Marable at least, the Pulitzer Prize in history. You have to have an ideological position that comports to what those in power find to be acceptable. And this is why all the establishment press came out to praise Marable's book, and why, in part of the point of my open letter to Tavis and West is that, or to Smiley and West, is that critics of Marable's book, principled critics of Marable's book, people who come with serious scholarship, journalism, and experience, are denied access into the public sphere, denied access into the realm of discussion of Malcolm X, in part because of this mainstream that supported Marable so much. This is the quintessential example of Chomsky and Herman's propaganda model, in terms of the press being used to uphold a mainstream or a dominant political and ideological position.
It also underscores what Malcolm talks about, the way that the press can, make your enemy become your friend and vice versa. You know, as we close out and, you know, folks that are listening, we're going to give you an opportunity to get a hold of this book by Jared Ball and Todd Burrows, which features an array of scholars. Again, the name of the book?
A Lie of Reinvention, Correcting Manning Marable's Malcolm X.
You mentioned the COINTELPRO edicts of separating black youth from militant thought. Now, you know, I just did an article recently called Malcolm X, Remembering When Malcolm X Was Hip-Hop's Greatest MC. And I did that very deliberately because, if you remember, in the late 80s, early 90s, Malcolm was sampled throughout a lot of people's records. Not only was he sampled a lot, he was featured on the cover of hip-hop's biggest magazine, which you would never see today. And he had such a strong presence in hip-hop from the 70s on up. I mean, in those old block parties, Malcolm's voice was heard, you know, in the parks and in the playgrounds because he was played over beats, Bambada and others. So even in death, Malcolm managed to have a presence very similar to the way Tupac has a presence to this day in death. So when dealing with that, first of all, does Manny even acknowledge that connection to Malcolm and the hip-hop youth? And how do you all see it in your book?
No, we don't really address that. That's funny you brought that up. That was actually one of the issues that my co-editor and I struggled a little bit with our publisher about, because we wanted to deal with that a little bit more aggressively. That point is not taken up by Marable or us in any real substantive way. So, but it is an extremely important point. And this is, again, you know, when Spike Lee's movie came out, Baraka, Daruba Bin Wahad, John Henrik Clark, Alombe Brath, and many other legends of the Pan-African struggle had gathered to talk about the resurgence of Malcolm in the popular culture for black youth being needed, requiring a response from the state that was Spike Lee's movie. That Spike's movie does very little to give you the real Malcolm X, particularly the Malcolm at the end of his life. And this was done in a way to sort of weaken, at least their argument in part, was that this was done in a way to weaken the impact Malcolm was having on the youth, particularly through hip-hop, as you were describing. And I think that this and other books, there have been, you know, the Bruce Perry book in the 90s was another example. A couple of others have come along to do just that, to say, we know that if we don't check it, Malcolm's image is unassailable. His memory is unassailable, and people will bring him back, and he will be, and most importantly, is that the conditions that produced Malcolm, that produced his critique, are still here. So right. People are still going to pick them up. And the goal here is to make sure that when we do pick it up again, we don't do it in the way that Malcolm was doing it, or in the way that would have the real impact Malcolm had intended, and that would allow us to just come back and vote for a Democrat.
What about the untimely death of Malcolm's grandson, you know, who was traveling the world in Syria and Libya and, you know, many ways, you know, was trying to, you know, come into political maturity. And, you know, and many, you know, and we're starting to do these international things even before his legendary grandfather.
That's right.
You know?
No, I mean, in terms of his age, you're right. He came to a political consciousness ahead of his grandfather, and was clear he was, at least from my vantage point, I never met him. I only know him, you know, through a mediated media experience and through mutual friends. But it to me was very clear that Malcolm was growing. He was looking to recover from the abuses of incarceration as a child, the abuses of growing up without his grandfather, the abuses of growing up in a largely unstable situation, and getting to the point where he was aligning himself with important people politically. When I saw him giving interviews on international media, he seemed to be, a far and above ahead and beyond where many of our so-called pundits and leaders are, who get much more mic time and camera time. So it's a very tragic incident that obviously I don't know much about what happened or what he was doing or what led to his death, but it's very sad. It's a tragic event, and it's something that, again, seems to happen at a moment when someone is beginning to make strides and make serious contributions intellectually and otherwise to our struggle, and someone who could give voice to our struggle and do it in a way that we definitely need it to be done.
And be a symbol to somebody who the FBI and COINTELPRO had tried to knock out.
Well, we've already seen that in some of the coverage of his death. Some even, again, black pundits and people who should know better are just parroting some of the mainstream notions of who Malcolm was, you know, talking about his tattoos and his teardrops and his incarcerated background and not really dealing with his politics or his ideas as they existed at the time he was killed, which, again, is something that seems to happen over and over again to his grandfather. And this is a tragedy on top of tragedies, you know.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up. Jared Ball, we appreciate it. What we're going to do is we're going to take a break, come back, let you know how you can get this book. We're also going to let you hear a little bit of Malcolm. We'll be right back.